ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
We're reading today from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter number 5, entitled Karma Yoga, Action in Krishna Consciousness, text number 24. Please repeat after me.
Yontasukontararamas tatantar jyotirevayaha sayogi brahma nirvanam Brahma Bhuto Dhigachati.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. One whose happiness is within, who is active and rejoices within, and whose aim is inward, is actually the perfect mystic. He is liberated in the Supreme, and ultimately he attains the Supreme. Purport. Unless one is able to relish happiness from within, how can one retire from the external engagements meant for deriving superficial happiness? A liberated person enjoys happiness by factual experience. He can, therefore, sit silently at any place and enjoy the activities of life from within. Such a liberated person no longer desires external material happiness. This state is called Brahma Bhuta, attaining which one is assured of going back to Godhead, back to home. So, and again, I'd like to thank all of you very much for sparing your precious time to be here with us tonight. It's a Saturday evening. There's so many things you could be doing, but the fact you've decided to spend it with us is very meaningful about your own desire for happiness and to find that search within. In one sense, my work is already completed because so many here experienced the ecstatic kirtan from our Chaitanya festival, and you've actually factually realized the factual experience of liberation through kirtan. I wasn't actually there for the kirtan, but I heard it, and it sounded really ecstatic. So today's purport is about realizing happiness, and this is a very nice change in the Gita, because for all of you who have been following along every day at our temple, the fifth chapter has been relatively bleak so far. It's talking about all the suffering and misery of this material world, how one has to tolerate all these problems, tolerate the forces of lust, of anger, how one should not engage in material happiness. But finally, Krishna in this verse is telling us about that supreme happiness. This is the rainbow at the end of the storm. After all so much effort being described in this chapter to control one's senses, now we learn about that internal happiness by which one goes back home, back to Godhead. So the question of happiness is a very important one because it's actually the unifying characteristic of every living entity. Guaranteed, every living entity in this room is acting for their own happiness. Prabhupada explains that the attractive feature of any service is that relationship mellow, the taste we get from it, and everybody in this world, whether they're a student, whether they're an adult, whether they're working, whether they're the dog on the street, everyone is looking for a little bit of happiness, and Krishna is giving some recommendations about the superior, best form of happiness. So the kind of framework I'd like to follow with tonight's class is the different grades of happiness and which ones we should aspire to if we want to taste the same eternal, internal happiness. And so the story given in this respect is of a boatman a long time ago was struggling very hard with his duty. Every day he would have to go down to the bank of the river and drag his boat along the thorny bank full of barnacles and sharp rocks. His feet would get cut. But nonetheless, he had no choice but to drag this boat every day. And so one day our boatman was lamenting. He was soothing his ailing, bleeding feet, and he thought, this job is so much trouble. But if I work hard enough one day, I'll accumulate enough wealth that I can avoid all pain by buying a gigantic piece of rubber. If I go to the store and get a huge foam mat, I'll unroll it along the bank of the river, and then when I drag the boat, I'll have a nice mat to walk on, and it'll be so comfortable. And so just as this man is contemplating, he gets another idea. He says, well, even better than the mat rolling along the river, it'd be way more affordable just to buy a pair of rubber shoes. And then all I would have to do is put on the rubber shoes, and then everywhere I walk, there's no more pain. And so he's thinking himself very clever. And then finally, one man goes, why are you wasting all this time in this useless speculation? Rather than work so hard dragging this boat, why not just give up this business? Forget all about this useless service and come with me. So our man, he's thinking of working so hard just to avoid the pain that comes as a concomitant factor of his service, but even easier is to just give up his job altogether and stop dragging boats along a thorny river. So this example is given because it's actually our position in the material world, because as Krishna explains, Mamupetya punarjanma dukhalayama shashvatam, every occupation and every duty, all the work we must perform, is actually inherently painful. Just like the pain he's experiencing walking along the thorns, every single one of us is experiencing so much misery right from the beginning of our work. And what's the evidence of this? Quite simply that it's like you're trying to push a car up a hill. Imagine you have a car, maybe it's set in neutral, the emergency brake is not on, and you're trying to push it up a steep hill. So it's so much labor, and if you stop even for a moment to release this car, it'll roll backwards and go all the way back to the bottom and crash. So therefore, by pushing this car, you don't get one single moment's respite, not a single moment of relief from carrying the burden of this heavy car. So in the same way, what is the pushing force of gravity that keeps us working in this world? And it's explained in the scripture that there's jita sadgunanam, the six whips of material existence. And what are these whips? These whips are hunger, thirst, illusion, their lamentation, their old age, and finally death. These six factors are haunting every single one of us, like a man behind us with a whip. Because even if you want to relax and not perform any work, still, your stomach will start grumbling. Your body will start demanding drink. You'll start demanding food. So there's never a question of being idle, because by the very force of time, we have to suffer from our stomach pain, from our throat parched. In the same way, through old age and death, all of us are racing against the clock to somehow or other make the most of our time in this world. And then that hankering, that desire to enjoy, is always whipping us forward like that. Like the ass, for example. How to get him moving? You dangle a carrot in front of his face so he's chasing the carrot. And if that doesn't work, then the donkey keeper keeps a stick and beats the donkey. So in the same way, all of us are trying to enjoy pleasure and avoid this pain. And that's what keeps us moving in this world. It's the underlying factor of action like that. So therefore, we have to act. We have no choice, because the very nature of time is that it degrades and destroys everything. As Krishna says, mrityu sarva harascham udbhavascha bhavishyatam, that among all the destroyers, haras, I am mrityu, I am death. And of all the generating principles, I am the creation, I am the birth, like that. So what Krishna is saying, in other words, is that we may lament so much about our dead relatives and our dead pet dog, and so much death is going on, but who's the actual factor behind that? And that's Krishna. In one sense of looking at it, Krishna is the ultimate serial killer from the whole universe. Why? Because everybody is dying by the force of his time. Kalosmi loka kshayat krit prabuddho lokan samahartum iha pravritta. Krishna tells Arjun that all these soldiers on the battlefield will succumb to the power of my energy, that I've killed everyone. So therefore, death is Krishna, and Krishna is also saying birth is me. And if we analyze our own lives, how much control do we have over birth or over death? Did anybody in this room remember opening up the catalog and choosing, oh, I'd like to take birth in Mumbai, Maharashtra, I'd like black hair, 5'8". Oh yeah, it'd be nice if I went to IIT. No one has this choice. No one has an online catalog where they order their future body. It's just given to us, and we have to make the most of it. Similarly, nobody chooses when they'd like to exit the world. Does anybody in this room know the exact moment of their death? We're under the impression that we'll live forever, but we could get cut off at any time. When I was on the plane coming back from Mayapur recently, we sat, actually it was Krishnanam Prabhu and I, he sat next to an airplane steward. And the steward was very receptive to Krishna consciousness because he had an experience in his life that completely rocked his world. One of his very close friends, for years, was unemployed. He had worked so hard in school to earn his degree, but still, no jobs anywhere. Finally, his eventful day came. He went for his interview in a big office, and they granted him the job. Finally, his money problems were over. He was on the mobile immediately, calling his girlfriend, calling his parents, telling him about the great news. He was finally financially stable. And as he was talking on the phone, he went down to the street and got on his motorcycle. And just as he was about to put on his helmet, he felt kind of an eerie feeling. And he couldn't quite tell what it was, but there was a shadow on his body. And he couldn't detect, where is this coming from? And the moment he looked up, finished. An air conditioner from the 20th floor of some building had become dislodged and had actually loosened from the building and had fallen at that exact moment on her friend who was just about to leave on his motorcycle. Finished in 1 second. So what is this crazy sense of humor that Krishna has to play these kind of tricks on us? But the point is, we don't know when we're going to die. Just like our friend, it could happen at any moment. I don't mean to frighten you going out on the street now. But we should be very wary about our existence. The fact that we can't choose our birth, you can't choose your death, but we're in the illusion of thinking that I control everything in between. That I control my job, my education, my children, my reproduction, my old age. Actually, everything is within the control of Krishna's energy, just like birth and death. But we have the power, the capacity to influence what takes place in between this birth and death. And this, in Sanskrit, is called karma. It's more or less our conscious activity of what we want to do and how we want to do it and what is the final goal of that. So therefore, every activity comes with a certain kind of corresponding faith. And so we're going to discuss those faiths right now. And our story begins with the ant and the grasshopper story. So one day there was a grasshopper lying down very peacefully in a meadow, and he was just soaking up the sun's rays. Beautiful day. He was just enjoying all the nectar from the plants and frolicking with his friends. And as he was enjoying like this, he happened to see an ant crawling by. And the ant had on his head a big piece of corn. And he was hauling this piece of corn. And he was just watching this grasshopper, and over and back and forth, this ant was working so hard, back and forth, carrying all this corn back to his den. And so the grasshopper had enough, and he stopped the ant, and he said, "Why are you working so hard? What's the point of all this labor?" And the ant told him, "Oh, don't you know? Winter is coming, and if we don't prepare for winter, we'll starve. There will be no food at that time." And the grasshopper is very skeptical. He says, "Why worry about that? There's plenty of food available right now. So why don't we come enjoy? You come with me, we'll go sing and dance. You forget about all this strenuous labor." But the ant said, "Uh-uh." And he just continued with his work, not heeding the warning of, Jai Shishi Radha Gopinath Bhagavan Ki Jai. So the grasshopper refused this good instruction. And sooner or later, winter came, and all the abundant supplies of nature, the bounty, was all finished. There was nothing left to eat. So this grasshopper was getting very skinny, and he was going from door to door, seeing who could help him. And he happened upon the anthill, and he said, "Hey, remember me? Your friend from the summer? And the ant just took one look at him and shut the door. And he said, one actually has to prepare for the times of necessity. This happy-go-lucky, devil-may-care attitude may yield us some short-term pleasure, but in the end, the consequences are highly regrettable. And so this is the function of intelligence. This is what Krishna is getting at in Bhagavad Gita, is that rather than simply enjoy in the moment, we should have the intelligence to discriminate between what's temporary and what's eternal. And so in this respect, he's saying that happiness we enjoy within is eternal and is of a much higher quality than the temporary happiness you can get just by enjoying your senses today. So in this respect, we see that as a nation in general, our great Bharatvarsha has fallen into this, let's say, condition or a complex of inferiority. This is my humble observation, is that more or less, it's become a very dependent nation by feeling itself very poverty-stricken, very victimized, and therefore, in order to enjoy happiness, we need to follow the superior example of the advanced industrialized nations. And more or less, anybody who goes to the West will have an experience in a big city that, wow, everything's clean, everything's so organized and efficient. You know, you don't have to wait for an hour to get your train ticket. You go to the office and, you know, they deal with you immediately at the bank. Everything's functioning smoothly. And so the impression is there that these are the countries or the people that are worth emulating. And very clearly we see so much enjoyment and sense gratification is factually taking place in the West. One example, which is quite telling, is of one Russian oligarch. Oligarch means one who rules on the basis of family connections or political ties like that. And today he's probably in the top 20 richest people in the world. His fortune is estimated at maybe, I don't know, $60 billion or something. So he's not in want of cash, our Russian oil magnate. He's in the oil industry. But the interesting thing to analyze about his life is that on the one hand, it's so enviable, the position he's in. He actually has a yacht. You know what a yacht is? It's like a luxury cruise boat. You kind of see him in Colaba sometimes. Like 150 feet long with a pool. The yacht is just like a playground for his vacations. Whenever he has some spare time, he goes sails around in the Mediterranean and entertains all his friends like that. But the problem is, even though he may have so much wealth, it comes accompanied with so much distress. Because being such a rich man automatically attracts envious, jealous people. And in the Mediterranean, there's a phenomenon of piracy. You may think of pirates as being guys with eye patches and parrots and peg legs and hooks firing cannons. But there's a very modern day kind of pirate still alive all over our international waters. And they prey on these luxury boats like that. Instead of these, you know, peg legs, they have AK-47 guns, and they actually mount these luxury cruise ships, take all the boarders, the passengers hostage, steal all the wealth on board, and take the yachts for their own pleasure like that. And so this Russian friend of ours, he's very careful about this, so he equipped his yacht with a radar system and actual missiles and torpedoes. And so it's not just your typical yacht you can buy at your corner yacht store. He actually had to have it commissioned by the German government, that there's actually a very ancient ship foundry dating back from World War II, and they're the ones who built his yacht. And as well, in case pirates mount his boat, he installed a little submarine that him and his wife can jump in the submarine and escape very discreetly out the back of the ship, leaving all his ship and crew and guards to, you know, face the pirates themselves. So the point is, he's always in perpetual fear. Even if he's on the deck of his ship, enjoying his meal with all his friends, he's constantly hounded by the fear that over the horizon at any moment, a pirate ship may come and devastate his entire life, may threaten his life, kill his friends. And so can we honestly say that our Russian billionaire friend is more happy enjoying his caviar or filet mignon than, let's say, an average typical housewife and her family and children in Dharavi slum, who are sitting in a little tin shack, but she's cooked a nice meal for her children. Her children are very grateful, and they're singing songs. They're happy. Even though they don't have so much wealth, still that relationship is there, and they're actually enjoying to a far higher degree than our Russian friend because they have peace of mind. Because no one's going to break into the little tin shack and tell me, oh, give me your floor mat, give me your stove, give me your any of these things. They're not in fear of thieves robbing them. So therefore, they have peace. And as Krishna says in Gita, nasti buddhire yuktasya, nasti buddhire yuktasya, nacha yuktasya bhavana, nacha bhavayata shantir, ashantasya kuta sukham. That in order to be sukham, happy, the prerequisite or the precondition is shanta. It's peacefulness. And so you can't be happy without peace. This is the statement of Bhagavad Gita. And so even though you may be so rich, if there's no peace, then what's the use? So herein lies the problem with modern material happiness, is that it can't purchase peace of mind. No matter how much money you have, no matter how much you're trying to enjoy, peace of mind is it's a commodity that can't be purchased with cash. It can only be purchased with knowledge. And this knowledge given in the same verse of Gita is that nasti buddhira yuktasya, without being in Krishna consciousness, that one cannot actually develop this bhavana, which is meditation on the Supreme. So without Krishna, you can't meditate on the Lord. Without this meditation, you can't be peaceful. And without this peace, you can't be happy. So this is the statement of Bhagavad Gita. And this experience has been borne out by people time and time again about the fact that no matter how much you try to enjoy these worldly pleasures, still, there's no satisfaction. Nothing. Like, for example, Prabhupada used the analogy of the old crows and the new crows. Some of you may have heard this, but my understanding of this analogy is that, let's say you go to your average hotel restaurant, and all the cooks just throw out the trash out the back, all the unused bottles, plastic, you know, maybe some, you know, vegetable like parings and clippings, but there's nothing really there. It's just garbage. The first ones on the scene are who? The crows. Dogs may be there, but for our example, the crows are the first one there, and they relish all the delicious juice and nectar from the garbage. But try as they might, the crows eventually realize that, hey, we're eating garbage. This is terrible. This is not actually giving us the pleasure we had sought. And the crows become very sick of this type of engagement and eventually go to look for some new, fresher garbage somewhere else. So this is the existence of a crow, is that they survive on the unused remnants of other people. And so as these old crows have left the scene, all of a sudden, a new flock comes into the picture. They spy a big heap of garbage from the distance, and they immediately start flying into the scene, start pecking each other, fighting each other over this garbage that's there. So not only is this garbage, it's actually used garbage. It's the garbage that's already been picked at by the previous crows. So really, there's nothing left there. So the old crows look on at the new crows and just kind of laugh at themselves. Because much as they try to preen around with their feathers and imagine that they're enjoying so much taste out of this garbage, factually, there's nothing left. You can't enjoy garbage. This is just the dead fact. So in the same way, what we witness today in the world is that by the influence of this gross, heavy sense gratification, so many Westerners are becoming sick of this sense gratification, becoming sick of their sinful lives. And what's the evidence? You take the example of vegetarianism. On the one hand, we recognize the personal dangers. There's so much obesity, heart disease, cholesterol problems in the West that just for the sake of one's own mental and physical well-being, people are giving up meat en masse. Thousands of people are converting to vegetarianism every single day in the Western world, while at the same time in India, thousands of people are converting to meat eating because it's such an attractive proposition. So in so many ways, meat eating is such a terrible thing. It pollutes the environment. It inflicts so much suffering on innocent living beings. And yet, out of that curiosity of the new crow who thinks there might be something there, that they actually developed determination to enjoy what the old crows were trying to enjoy like that. Or you take the example of like anything, really. I mean, dressing, for example. Like in the West, you know, out of personal experience, we see that so many young girls who are being trained by the media and influences to dress very scandalously, it exposes them up to so much victimization by unscrupulous men, as it said. There's so much rape, so much divorce, so much using women just like a useless commodity that we can enjoy with them temporarily and then cast them aside. So many are being disturbed by this complete commoditization of females and are actually looking to dress more conservatively, to be more chaste in their own lives, to better adhere to principles of religion. It's a fact. So in the same way in India, you find the opposite trend is there, is that people are becoming more and more enamored of this style of dress and this style of acting and being more forward and bold. But all it is this shame or this embarrassment about one's own culture. So the next point that we'll try to make is that actually the pleasure that's being experienced in the West is of a far inferior quality because it's only sensual. It's only dealing with the senses, and it's basically on the animal platform. Is that even if you want to enjoy, like our Russian friend here, eat fine foods, sleep with, you know, beautiful people and enjoy to the max, nonetheless, what's the problem is that even if you want to sleep well, there's bears out there who sleep for 6 months of the year. They go into hibernation. Can you have better sleep than a bear? Or sex. We have pigeons who can do it 60 times a day. Can any Russian billionaire do that 60 times a day? Or you have defending. Some tigers are equipped with claws. Skunks have, you know, a very vicious scent. But humans, what means do we have for defending? We're inferior to the animals in every respect. So the prerogative of the human form of birth is actually to enjoy higher spiritual pleasures. And so one may question, well, you know, you might say, ghar ki murgi dal barabar hai, that actually, because we've been doing vegetarianism for so long, we've been doing this religion thing for so long, I don't want to dress like my grandmother, I have to dress modern. And so we've become so complacent about our own culture that we just want to trade. And as they say, the grass is greener on the other side. But is that really the case? Clearly no, because what's being argued here in the Gita is a form of happiness that is accessible only to human beings, and therefore human beings can taste special pleasure. What's that? On the mental platform. So we've discussed sensual platform. Now we're going to discuss what is mental pleasure. And this is the special right or privilege of India through its vast knowledge in these literatures of the Vedas that actually gives the hint or the secret to how to enjoy on a higher platform. So whereas the sensual pleasure, we'll say, was like walking on the rocks, now we're talking about the higher pleasure, which is like putting out the foam pad all over the bank, and wherever you go, you can be somewhat distress-free. So this mental pleasure is actually produced on the mental platform or emotional platform. So in Sanskrit, this is called svargiya ras. The first type of rasa that we described was called partiva ras. Partiva means of this mundane world, this mrityu loka. Everybody is enjoying sensual pleasure. But now let's talk about heavenly pleasure. What is that pleasure that is accessible only to those in the mode of goodness and to those who have more elevated consciousness? And to boil it down, what it comes down to is relationship. Whereas our Russian billionaire, his relationship with his, you know, 20-year-old, you know, supermodel girlfriend is very superficial. Because she married him because of his wealth, he married her because of her looks, and as soon as he loses his wealth, bam, she's off somewhere else. As soon as she loses her looks and gets old, he dispenses with her and gets another 20-year-old supermodel. There's a saying amongst very unscrupulous people in the West is that it's great because the older that I get, college girls stay the same age. So the mentality is that even though I can get old and I can throw away my girlfriends or my wives when they don't suit my taste. I'll just get a new one, because this is the special position that a rich man is in. And so this is the pride that fills this man. And so therefore, my argument is that their relationship is highly superficial. It's only based on the senses. And there can be no real trust, for all his wife knows, while she's enjoying in some villa in the Swiss Alps or something, then he's out on his yacht with his mistress. And it's so common. All these rich people guaranteed have one relationship over here in their family, but for a little bit of spice and excitement, they have the other girlfriend in Moscow, and then the one in London, and then the one on a boat in the Mediterranean. So the relationships are very paper thin. There's zero substance to them whatsoever. On the other hand, what we find in India is relationships of substance. So for example, the marriages, the divorce rate. How much more elevated is the divorce rate in the West? Statistics say that over 3/4 of all marriages where I'm from in Canada end in divorce after 3 years. In some places it's worse, some places it's not as bad. And this is an old statistic, actually. As I heard from one source, that the divorce rate has actually decreased in recent years. But statistics can be very misleading. They say that don't trust 70% of statistics. But how is it that this statistic is misleading? Because even though the divorce rate is decreasing, does this mean that more people are staying together? That the relationships are more successful, more fulfilling? It's quite the opposite. The fact is, the aggregate level of marriages is declining. So whereas you had 100 marriages before, and 75 of them end in divorce, now you only have like 20 divorces, and maybe 18 of them stay together. So the point is, those who wanted to get married are still doing it, and those who didn't want to get married are just avoiding the whole thing altogether. Why even bother getting into this agreement if it's just going to end anyway? So therefore, they live as common law partners, which means no commitment, no responsibilities, no alimony, no potential divorce fees. If your wife divorces you, you have to start paying her every month. So in order to avoid that risk, better to just not get married at all. And this is very common. I had one Prabhupada disciple told me he applied to rent an apartment in Amsterdam in one office building. And he said, yeah, me and my wife were looking for a place. And he said, oh, you're married? Sorry, you can't live here. What? Excuse me? He says, yeah, we only allow common law partners here. We don't let married people into our building. And so this is what's going on in the West. It's completely backwards. And Prabhupada gives a nice saying, actually. It's funny. I hope it's not offensive. But he says, when there's milk in the market, why bother to keep a cow? If I can go to any store I want and just give a few rupees and automatically get all the milk I want, then why bother brushing, feeding, cleaning? If my cow gets sick, then I have to give it medicine. If it gets old, there's so much distress, I have to get it. And so rather than keep the trouble of maintaining this cow, then why not just forget about the whole thing and just go buy the milk like that? And so the principle is that the cow has so much to offer. And for our Russian friend, you know, these women have so much to offer, but it's so much trouble. So why not just make things temporary? We'll let go of this whole religious ritual, and we'll just live more according to our senses in the moment. And so as a result, the relationships are not stable, and as a result, the moral condition of the people is not very high, and the actual satisfaction that one derives from a family relationship is highly reduced. Because when one is not secure in a relationship, then one is always doubting the other partner. Not only that, but the children get affected in so many adverse ways. For example, myself, I've never met an Indian man or boy personally who didn't get a little bit teary-eyed when he was talking about his mother. I know so many stories about until they were 16 years old, their mother would sit them down on their lap, comb their hair. They would actually prepare nice food for them every single day. They would like walk them to the school, ask them how they were doing. And because of that close bond between the son and the mother, that this sense of giving back to the family, of giving back to the community, giving back to the parents is so strong in India. Whereas in the West, people are eager to just kick their parents out of the house and stick them in some retirement home, maybe call them once a year at most. In India, there's still the concept of a joint family where you can live with all your relatives and enjoy the rasa that's there. Because even if, like, let's say you have a businessman who's very rich, and even though his wife may be so old, she may be getting so wrinkled, but it doesn't really matter because never at any cost will he ever even consider divorcing her. Why? Because that would upset the relationship in the family. It would devastate the kids. It would be so harmful for one's status in the community. And plus, this is the woman that raised his children. He has an obligation to her. And this obligation is called dharma. It's actually called sacrifice. One gives up one's own temporary pleasures in order to serve another. And so this concept is so endangered in the West of actually serving another person and maybe accepting some inconvenience or some difficulty on my part. But I guarantee by this minor austerity of just trying to enjoy according to the mode of goodness will actually yield more pleasure in the long haul than will this temporary sense pleasure. And that's the reason why, more or less, Indians are taking over the whole world economy, because actually they have good character. They're dependable. They're loyal. Whereas in the West, we don't find so many satisfied IT workers because all their jobs are being stolen by the Indians. So it has a lot to do with these principles of dharma. And simply by following this dharma, one can enjoy a greater standard of happiness in life like this. And so, but at the same time, you see that the Westerners aren't very attracted to religion at all. They think, well, it's putting so many rules and restrictions on my life, rather to just better to enjoy in the moment. But the point is, they can actually have no access to what is this svargiya ras, because they've never tasted it. Once, when we were preaching, we tried to explain to a young boy how God or Krishna is like the Supreme Father, and therefore you can place your trust and faith in him, he'll take care. But this boy just stared back blankly, because he couldn't relate to the analogy. I asked, and it turns out, actually, he had never had a real father at home. That his father had abandoned his family when he was maybe 5 or 6 years old. He never had a real relationship with them. And so for him, the principle of father means someone you can't trust, someone who's just going to go away, to go off with somebody else at any moment. And so how can this person understand what it means to have a loving relationship with God? There's just no concept is there. So in Hindi, you say, Bandar kya jani adrak ka swad? If you've never tasted the pleasure of real satisfaction in family life or real relationships, then you doubt relationships and you want nothing to do with them. So when I was answering questions in my college preaching days 2 years ago, many questions we would get is about how do we get that higher taste? In the Gita, Krishna says, rasa varjam rasopyasya param drishtva nivartate, that when one gives up this lower taste, automatically one yearns and one can actually experience what is this higher taste. And so higher taste is something very elevated. This verse is talking about connection with the super soul. It's actually talking about sitting anywhere at any time and just feeling happiness from within without any external stimuli. So very few of us, or on occasion, we've experienced some of this higher taste in kirtan, in chanting, in our japa, hearing a nice class, that something will arouse some of this higher taste. But it's very hard to achieve. And so how do we get this higher taste? The problem is we've never experienced the higher taste. We have to take it on faith. You just kind of have to believe that it's there and that Srila Prabhupada is not deceiving us. The acharyas are not deceiving us. Krishna is telling us the truth. He has nothing to gain by actually telling us to worship him. For him, he's trying to help us. And so we've never experienced it. But on the other hand, my observation was that these boys I was preaching to in the college, neither had they experienced the higher taste, neither had they experienced the lower taste. So given the choice of going to the temple and enjoying, at the same time they can watch TV, watch the movies, and see people enjoying so much sinful activity and being so tough and macho and so amazingly, like through a life of crime and through a life of sin and sex and womanizing, that I too, through this intoxication, can also become happy. So the problem is neither lower, neither higher. The Indians are somewhere in between, in the middle tastes. And this is a very interesting position because one can either place one's faith in the lower or place one's faith in the higher. Those who do end up choosing the lower are being very, very foolish, according to Krishna. He explains, again, in the 7th chapter, Antavattu palam tesham tadbhavat alpa medhasam devan devaya joyanti madbhakta yaddimamapi, that one who is alpa medhasa, has a little tiny bit of intelligence, very small intelligence, what does he do? He worships the demigods, Indra, Varuna, Shiva, all these for material pleasure. And where does he go? Devan devaya joyanti. He goes to these demigods' planets, and he enjoys on such a higher level of sense gratification than he ever possibly could here. Because why? Here you have 100 years maximum. Right? You can't enjoy to a great degree here, whereas in the heavenly planets, you're enjoying for tens of thousands of years. You have the best house, the best car, the best looking women, the best looking men, the best house. Everything is like the happiness here, but multiplied many thousands and thousands of times. So for someone to actually make some attempt to enjoy the paltry, meager pleasures of this planet is actually very foolish, Krishna is saying. Small intelligence. Why? Because it's still antavat. It still possesses an end. It will come to its own logical conclusion, and it will all be finished. So even one who is trying to enjoy material pleasure on such a high degree eventually has to come back to mrityuloka. As Krishna says, he says, Tetam bhuktva svarga lokam vishalam kshine punye martya lokam vishanti evam trai dharma mamunuprapanna gatagatam kama kama labhante. That after enjoying so much heavenly pleasure, maybe your grandparents or the history books talk about this kind of heavenly pleasure, but after enjoying that for so long, eventually, kshine punye, all your punya, your pious credits become finished, and martya lokam vishanti. You have to fall down to this world. So this is a big problem. But today, people don't read the Vedas. People don't have faith in this heavenly planets, in this heavenly pleasure. So this is a problem. Because as Krishna, Prabhupada explains in this verse, he says that even if we don't worship a demigod to get our material desires fulfilled, we'll simply worship a powerful person. He says, Yajanta iha devataha. So devata, in the traditional sense, means one of the demigods. But in the absence of such faith, one simply places one's faith in a powerful living entity. So the faith principle is always there, that someone will grant my desires, someone will fulfill me. And who is this today? It's our boss at work. It's the person who controls our salary. If we impress this politician or this industrialist or we make some connections in this world, then by pleasing these people, we can, you know, gradually climb the corporate ladder. We can actually become socially progressive in this world. So we've just replaced one thing for another. As Krishna says in the previous verse, he says, Trividyamam soma paputa papa. This trividya, by actually following the three Vedas, then yagyair ishva svargatim, we attain to svarga like that. But because people today have no conception of the three Vedas, they have no conception of, you know, svarga. So what has replaced the three Vedas? You look out on the billboards. You look out on the advertisements in the train station. What is the supreme source of knowledge that will guarantee happiness in this world? It's the GRE, the GMAT, the TOEFL examination. If we simply do well on these standardized examinations, then we have a chance to get my degree and to travel to the West and enjoy this pleasure and it, like the heavenly Americans do. But eventually, your visa has to expire, the economy crashes, you have to come back to India eventually. So none of it lasts forever. Even if you want to enjoy overseas, even if you want to enjoy up there, it still comes with an end. So how can we possibly experience any pleasure from something which is destined to decay and to die like that? So this naturally leads the intelligent individual to contemplate, so beyond this temporary pleasures, what else is left for us to enjoy? And this pastime is, or this point is brought out very nicely in the Bhagavatam when we see Maharaj Yayati. We can't go into depth with the pastime, but he ends up getting cursed by Shukracharya, even though he's a great wealthy king, the king of the whole earth. He's enjoying so much sense pleasure in his palace with his beautiful wives. Still, he's cursed by Shukracharya that his body will become decrepit, that he actually has to succumb to old age prematurely. Shukracharya curses him that from today onwards, you will be an old man. And Maharaj Yayati is begging and pleading that, please, how will I enjoy this world if I don't have a healthy, strong body with which to enjoy my senses? Please give me a concession. I regret what I've done. And Shukracharya gives him the chance that if you can arrange for one of your sons to give up his youth and exchange it for your old age, then you can take his youth and you can enjoy for 1,000 years, no problem. But your son has to agree. And so Maharaj Yayati goes back to his family and he pleads. He has 5 sons. He pleads with his eldest son. He says, look, son, they say that the son's duty is to serve the father. Therefore, you have to obey me and you take my old body and you give me your youth. And his son says, no way. He says, I need to become a great devotee of the Lord. And if I don't have my healthy body to enjoy, how will I become sick of the sense pleasure? How will I become a good devotee? So forget about it. His further sons also deny his father. So his father, his final recourse is Puru, his youngest son. And he asks Puru, and Puru, as this very faithful, loyal son, agrees to give up his own youthful vigor and trade it with his father's. So Maharaj Yayati, very grateful to his son, takes his young body and goes off and enjoys. And for the next 1,000 years, it's explained that he's enjoying so many nice relationships with his beautiful young wives. He has his own mistresses. He's performing sacrifices. He's giving in charity. He's enjoying like any worldly king can to the utmost degree. But finally, he comes to the conclusion after this 1,000-year span of enjoyment that day by day, my material desires are just inflaming further and further. As the Gita says, kama rupena konteya dushpurena nalena cha, that these desires, just like pouring ghee will inflame the blazing inferno, in the same way, simply trying to satisfy these desires will just grow these blazing flames ever and ever, greater and greater. And so Yati comes to the realization after 1,000 years that better I serve Krishna. Better that I give my heart and my soul to serving the Supreme Lord. But the problem is, with Maharaj Yayati, is actually not the problem. He's actually doing us a service. Because we don't have 1,000 years to live. We can't enjoy to that span like that. We think that, well, this is one story, and since I'll never have access to that level of sense gratification, maybe I should just take it on faith that perhaps Maharaj Yayati's example is worth following. And even though he had to go through the experience of having to struggle for 1,000 years, I can surrender right now, this minute, if I really want. And I can give my life to Krishna. And I don't have to go through the whole process. So this is the point that Krishna is making, is that there's so many levels of happiness. On the one hand, it's called Vaikuntaras, or the experience of happiness or pleasure that Yayati Maharaj is experiencing at the end. We can take it up now if we want. We don't have to go through this partiva, this Svargiras. Just give yourself to Krishna and that pleasure will be eternal. But of course, not everybody is on that platform, and that's perfectly acceptable because not everybody responds well to good instructions. As it said, Laton ke bhut. You know the next part. Bhaton se manta nahin. Please forgive me for my broken Hindi. But the point is, if we want to enjoy pleasure right now, it's foolish because already the example is given. Don't do it. Just give your life to Krishna. But you have to go and experience, you have to get beaten, you have to get kicked, and finally you'll eventually come to that realization. And that's perfectly fine, provided that you practice your karma, or you practice your activities in the mode of goodness according to Shastra. So in the 16th chapter, Krishna says, Ye Shastra vidim utrijya vartate kama karataha nasa siddhim avapnoti na sukham na param gatim. That one who these Shastra vidhi, the rules of scripture, one who throws them away, tries to enjoy in such an illicit way, like our first example, for him, nasa siddhim, there's no perfection. There is no sukham, there's no pleasure, and there's no param gatim, there's no supreme destination. So one throws away the rules of scripture at one's own expense, at one's own risk. That though you may squeeze a little bit enjoyment temporarily, still you'll never get the supreme destination. It's only by following scriptures that one can advance in devotional service, that one can actually experience a higher standard of pleasure like that. So therefore, one is well advised. And finally, here's a story that Shamanand Prabhu gives, which I think is instructive, is about one king, and there's a merchant in his kingdom, and the merchant commits a heinous crime, that he's actually cheating other people, and so he's arrested by the guards, and he's brought in, and the king is about to dispense his punishment on this poor merchant. And our merchant, he's known to be a very gross miser, that he just wants to pinch every penny he can. And so the king says, so we're going to punish you now. And the punishment for you is 100 gold coins. Immediately, give it up. And so the merchant, he's very worried. And he says, no, anything but that. I don't want to give up any of this. Please help me. And so the king says, fine. Then we'll give you an alternative. Rather than these 100 gold coins, you have two other choices. Either we can give you 50 whiplashes on the back, or you can drink 5 kilos of hot ghee. Which would you prefer? And so the man's thinking about this. He says, well, anything's better than the taxes, but I'll go for the whiplashes. That sounds 50, you know, just deal with it and it's over. And so he agrees. And so the king's guards, they wind up with their lash. And the first one, crack! And he goes, ah! The first whap was so painful. It's so excruciating. And yet he just bites his lip. And the second whip, whoosh. And then, again. He says, I can't go on with this. The first two are so bad. I can't imagine what 50 is like. Please spare me. And so the king's very merciful. He says, fine. You've come down to the next alternative. We'll let you drink ghee. And so he calls for the hot ghee to get boiled. And so this man says, okay. And so he's about to drink his ghee, and finally, as soon as it touches his tongue and enters his throat, it starts burning, and he's drinking, and the pain is so terrible. After 1 kilo, his stomach is so bloated, and he's in such excruciating pain that he says, no more, I can't even drink 2 kilos, what to speak of 5. Just give me anything else. And the king says, okay, give me the 100 coins, like that. So in the end, we find that what happened to our silly merchant is that instead of taking the first option right away, he could have just accepted, you know, the tax, it's not so bad. He had to experience all three. So why bother to experience all three when right from the beginning, you can just do the work of devotional service? I give my life to Krishna. I don't have to worry about all the rules or regulations. I don't have to worry about being a gross sense enjoyer. Simply give my life to Krishna, and everything will be okay. And maybe some work, the results may not come instantly, but eventually we'll be able to retire from the eternal engagements and be able to relish happiness from within by this gradual process. So I thank you very much for your kind attention. Are there any questions, comments, or corrections from the crowd? Yes, Prabhu, please.
Hare Krishna, please accept my salutations.
Thank you.
I need to ask you two questions. I'm a novice in Krishna consciousness, and I hope whatever I ask will not come as an offense to you or the other devotees out here. Well, we mentioned the question of sense gratification, that, okay, multiplying passions with engaging with women, endless number of women, is very, very wrong. It gets you further into samsara. But then in the Vedic culture, why is marriage held to be a very sacred institution?
Thank you for your question. Prabhupada gives a nice example in this respect, is that once when he was a child, he was in the house with all his relatives, and I think it was his brother or something, there was a fan, a rotating electric fan. And out of the natural childish curiosity, this one young boy, he decided, what's going to happen if I stick my finger in the fan, as children are apt to do? Even though they're told not to, they'll still do it. And so the whole family immediately intervened and told the child, no, no, don't put your finger in the fan. Just stop. Just believe us. Don't do it. It's wrong. And so this boy backed away. And immediately at that moment, the uncle came in. And he told the family, he said, what are you thinking? You don't know anything about raising children. If we tell this boy to not stick his finger in the fan, then that suspicion will always be there in his mind that maybe my parents are telling me not to do this because it's actually really fun and it's actually really nice. So the child does not fully believe until he gets an experience. So the uncle instructs the family, let's unplug the fan, and as the fan is slowing down, then he can stick his finger in to his heart's content. And so they do that. And then the little boy, he's getting ready. They unplug the fan. He puts his finger in there. And then he gets so much pain. And he runs away crying like that. And then the whole family starts laughing. So on the one hand, if he had stuck it in immediately, it might have cut off his finger. But because they removed the electric current, then he gets to experience some distress. But simultaneously, he's convinced. And he'll never do it again. He'll never stick his finger in the fan again. So in the same way, that's why material pleasures are given to the living entity, because we'll never be convinced right from the beginning. If anybody just tries to tell us right off the bat that don't even bother with family life, you know, this whole relationship, it's so artificial. We may have some intellectual understanding, but still because of the mind's attachments, we're actually attached to family life and to family pleasure. Therefore, you do it, you go for it, enjoy your children, your wife, your properties, your possessions, your work, but do it in a regulated way. And so by unplugging the fan, you're actually following Kula Dharma, which is the rules of the scriptures for family life. And so therefore, you experience family life, and you experience the full joy that it has to offer. Because if you can live and have nice relationships with your children, they respect you nicely, they want to support you in your old age, and your wife and your husband are they're loyal to one another, and all the family is very harmonious, then you think, I've experienced it all. That everything marriage life had to offer me, at the end, you realize that I've tasted it. And because I've tasted it, now I'm in a position to say, it's not really satisfying my deepest heart's cravings, that there's something still missing. Just like Maharaj Yayati, there's something a little bit absent in my life. And therefore, that's why the Vanaprastha Ashram is intended, after your married life, to actually retire from those married activities. So this is the fruition of a successful married life, is to become more renounced like that. But initially, one has to follow it very nicely. So the risk we take by not following married life according to the injunctions of Scripture, and we do it foolishly according to one's own whims, as Krishna says, vartate kama kartaha, is that, you know, your kid will turn into a drug addict, your daughter will get pregnant at 13, your wife will leave you, everything will be in shambles, and you may think that, oh, you know what, this wife was the problem. She was a bad woman to marry, we weren't compatible, therefore, I'll just get a new one. And then when that relationship doesn't work, you throw her out, you get a new one. And so because you're not following the Vedic Dharma according to a T, then so much suffering will come. And you'll never taste the full svargiya ras, the full, you know, fruition or fulfillment of family pleasure. So that's why India is so much more infinitely enlightened about how to run family life properly, and because it's connected to Shastra, it'll always yield a good result, provided that we bring our lives in harmony with Krishna's orders, with his laws like that.
Thank you very much. I have a second question.
Please.
You mentioned about demigods, and one of them is Shiva. When you categorize Shiva as a demigod, I believe in the latter half of the Bhagavad Gita, somewhere it's mentioned, amongst the Rudras, I am Shankara.
So Shiva Tattva is a very vast subject, but there's actually many personalities who are referred to as Shiva. One is Shiva, who is known as Rudra, who is responsible for the destruction of this material world, and he's expanded from Lord Brahma's forehead, from his anger, like that. So this Lord Shiva is in a different category than Sadashiva, and this Sadashiva is the one that you're referring to in Gita, who is the eternal one, who is actually, he's very cognate with Mahavishnu, in that he's actually responsible for the administration from outside of the material world. So one resides in Vaikuntha, one resides inside the material universe. So this is the answer.
Fine.
Is that okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, just one last crack, because it makes me so sick to see people give up their culture like this. Because India is not just another mundane culture. Like, for example, if we were to go to Peru and give this lecture, we wouldn't tell people to pick up Peruvian culture or Italian culture or Greek culture. Indian culture is special because this is the place where Lord Krishna decides to manifest his pastimes. And this is the culture which he voluntarily adopts when he performs pastimes in this world. So when Krishna comes to Dwarka, for example, he's actually living his life perfectly according to Shastra. Of the 64 qualities attributed to Krishna, one is that he follows scripture very closely, and he knows all the Vedas. So in the same way, Dwarka Krishna is doing everything according to Shastra, like that. So this deception is summarized in this story of the fox and the goat. One day there was a fox just walking down the countryside, and accidentally he falls into a well that was hidden. And so he's at the bottom of this well, and this fox has no chance of escaping from this well. But at the same time, another goat walks along the top, and the fox sees the goat, and the fox asks him, "Hey, save me." And the goat looks up at the top and down, and he says, "Oh, sorry, what can I do?" And he says, "Sorry, I didn't mean save me. I said, what are you doing up there at the top of the well?" And the goat says, "What do you mean? What are you doing at the bottom of the well?" And the fox goes, "Bottom of the well? Didn't you know? Didn't you hear? The weather forecast? There will be a big flood. A big tsunami will come. Or sorry, my fault for getting the story wrong. There will be a big drought. There will be no water. Everybody on the surface will be so parched. There will be no food to eat. There will be nothing to drink. The only one who will survive are the people at the bottom of the well, because we'll have water." And the goat says, "Oh really, maybe I should jump in too." And so the goat jumps into the bottom of the well. And as soon as he's there, the fox jumps on the goat's head and jumps his way out of the well, like that. And so the fox looks down and gives him this advice. He says, "Never trust the advice of one who's in difficulty." So the fox is comparable to, we could say, you know, the American civilization or the big mass media from the West, who is trying to extract profit and resources off the Indian country, because there's so much population here, it's such an untapped market. By selling people on consumerism, selling people on sense gratification, they're actually deriving so much profit off of this activity. So an intelligent thing is to see that actually these people just want us for the money and don't really have our best interest in mind. If the goat is just happy at the top of the well and forgets all about the fox, then he can go on with his business nicely. It's only by his illusion that he'll jump to the bottom of the well. So that's my concluding point. I pray that all of you will very sincerely continue to bless us at this temple with your presence and your association and through your patient and very submissive listening to Bhagavad Gita. I thank you very much for your time. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki, Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagavan ki, Shri Bhagavad Gita ki, Jai. Nitai Gaur Premanande, Hari Hari Bol.